This is Cincinnati Edition. I'm Jay Hanselman with Howard Wilkinson. There are two candidates who want to succeed Mark Mallory as the next Cincinnati mayor. One of them is Roxanne Qualls. She was first elected to city council in 1991 and served as the city's mayor from 1993 to 1999 when the top vote-getter in the council race was named mayor. She left City Hall in 1999 because of term limits. She rejoined council in 2007 after Jim Tarbell left early due to term limits. She ran successful campaigns to remain on council in 2007, 2009, and 2011. Now she wants to be mayor again, and she's joining us in the studio. We are taping this segment, so we won't be able to include your phone calls or emails. Ms. Qualls, thanks for joining us.
Well, thank you for having me.
To start off with, in your mind, your background and experience, what qualifies you to be Cincinnati's next mayor?
I started out working in neighborhoods as a community organizer, working in many of Cincinnati's communities as they were trying to protect their residents and families from pollution. Also, was the director of two not-for-profit crisis centers that served women and children who were victims of domestic assault and sexual assault. So have experience both in Cincinnati neighborhoods on the ground as well as working as the director, managing budgets of two human services organizations, but then served on council, as you just said, for 8 years, six of those as mayor, and during my time as mayor, really worked in partnership with the business community, with neighborhood leadership, to bring to fruition many of the projects that we are now celebrating today. You know, put in place the basic infrastructure and master plan that resulted in the banks and Smale Riverfront Park, led the effort to actually cut Fort Washington Way in half and reconnect downtown to the riverfront, lobbied for the state to establish the TIF districts that make the funding of much of the development we see possible, and, you know, and finally, actually, I'm very proud of the fact that was a very strong partner to make sure that we kept our two ball teams in town by building the stadiums.
What do you would you say sets you apart from your opponent in this race?
I think what sets me apart from Mr. Cranley are a couple things. One is the experience I bring to office, which is, you know, as a community organizer, as a mayor, as a member of council, but also as someone who has both gone out and taken the time to reflect on my experience, to become a student again and really study and learn much more about what makes for successful cities, and to come back in office and apply those lessons. And as I mentioned before, also direct experience in actually running two organizations very early on in my career, that managing budgets and managing people. The other thing that sets me apart is I think both my judgment as well as my temperament in terms of approaching those things that need to get done, which oftentimes can be contentious, and having the ability to bring people together around a common shared vision. I think I've also demonstrated that many of the things that we try to do in the city, there are lots of folks who say we can't do them, we shouldn't do them, and if we were to listen to them, we would not be where we are today, and so have the persistence and toughness to make sure that we actually do put in place the things that we know we need to do to make progress in the city.
You've been one of the most ardent proponents of the streetcar project, which is already underway,
yes.
Obviously, if not the most ardent supporter of it. But obviously, there are many people who have been opposed to this. There are others who support it. And there are many who say that it's not going to work unless it is completed, until that connection to Uptown is done. You've said that you would, as mayor, mm-hmm. one of the first things you'd do is go to Washington and try to find money mm-hmm. to be able to complete that project. What if the money's not there? Then what do you do?
Well, a couple things. I want backing up just a little bit. Every journey of 1,000 miles begins with the first step. The interstate highway system was not completely built out the day that they announced it. And so when we look at putting in place the streetcar and ultimately making the connection from downtown all the way to the university and medical complex of Uptown, we have to begin. We have to take that first step, just like the Eisenhower folks did when they were putting in place the Eisenhower interstate highway system. So it is important that we get the first step from downtown to Findlay Market and over the Rhine done. And one of the things I think that people need to know is we know that there will be a return on that investment, even if it just is for that segment. We are already seeing property change hands. We're already seeing developments announced, people investing in new residential apartment buildings, people investing in businesses. And so we already are proving the point that this is a good economic development project. Getting it to Uptown, though, really means that we then begin to open up the neighborhoods of Avondale and Clifton and Coryville and Cuff and Mount Auburn to the same type of intensive residential and commercial development that we hope to further spur in Over the Rhine and downtown. The Obama administration is committed to rail. This is a signature project of the Obama administration, and so I fully expect that the federal government will support the extension. They have been very supportive in terms of sticking with the project in the city of Cincinnati, and we saw that even as this has been delayed because of two ballot initiatives by the opponents.
John Dietrich was recently brought on by the city to manage the streetcar
yes.
project. Should that change of leadership happen sooner than it did?
I have had been urging the change of leadership for a much longer period of time than it should have taken. But the good news is the change of leadership did occur. Dietrich is an exceptional project manager. He proved that at Fort Washington Way. He proved that managing the banks. And I am just very pleased that he is in charge of the project now.
The Port Authority has recently released details of the draft
yes.
agreements with the companies that would run the parking meter system and the garages and the surface lots. I'm sure you've read those drafts. What do you think of the results of what the Port Authority has come up with? Is it adequate for the city's needs?
I think that the parking modernization plan in general is a smart, sound, and fair investment. And the Port Authority, in the process that they've used to review the contracts and to review the bond agreements, you know, assembled expert teams from Procter & Gamble, from Western Southern, from Kroger to tear apart the agreements and to look at where they could be improved and then put them back together. We see the improvements with the Xerox contract, that it is 10 years with two 10-year renewal periods, that there are very, very concrete reporting requirements, that there's more transparency in terms of costs and more accountability. And so and the bottom line conclusion of the review by the expert panels was that this was a very good contract. The $4.5 million that I think people are reading about, what's not being said in the article so far is that $4.5 million annually includes expenses for running the system. And so, in essence, Xerox is actually making, in terms of a contract fee, about 10% of that, so $450,000. The Denson contract, even better news. It was originally a much longer-term contract, and what is now on the table is it's a 3-year contract with Denson. So if they don't perform, they're out, and another operator will be brought in by the port.
That accountability issue, I think, has a lot of people concerned. They have the concerns about a private company coming in here and having incentives to write as many tickets as possible.
There are no incentives in the agreement for them to write as many tickets as possible.
Well, they want to make up their investment.
There's no, because what people do need to understand is that Xerox is a contractor who is operating the system, and that their incentive is to actually manage the system well, which means making sure that the meters are operating properly, making sure that if someone has 3 or more tickets, that yes, there is enforcement, just as we do now. But there is no incentive for aggressive enforcement of tickets built into this contract. If anything, what the incentive is for them to reduce their costs, because as they reduce their costs, then they get to actually keep a portion of that savings that they have. So if you people carefully reading the agreement will see that all of the fear-mongering around aggressive enforcement and incentives to enforce and incentives to boot are not there. The enforcement is going to be basically the same as the city currently does now.
You mentioned in the opening question your background was working with neighborhoods.
Mm-hmm.
And this during campaigns, there's always this tension between downtown getting all the attention when it comes to economic development and some of the neighborhoods say, what about us? What, and I think you have a neighborhood plan. What is in your plan for those neighborhoods that would be saying, what about us?
Well, first of all, one of the things which I thought was something that we also were celebrating, you know, not just the banks and Smale and Fountain Square and Over the Rhine, but was the fact that we as a city were finally at the point where it wasn't downtown versus the neighborhoods. Because what you see over the last 6 years is the city of Cincinnati very concretely engaging in the neighborhoods and investing in the neighborhoods in projects that are making a difference. And in fact, between 2008 and 2012, between economic development and community development, we invested almost $500 million throughout the city. 60% of it, $300 million, went into areas outside of downtown Cincinnati. And so, you know, John Cranley's project in East Price Hill that he touts so much as one of his qualifications, the city put $750,000 into that project. We just approved spending $2.5 million to support the development of the theater in East Price Hill and another $3 million to streetscape Price Avenue, which is becoming the focal point of a new neighborhood business district in that area. We've invested in Evanston, tearing down the St. Ledger, building new townhomes, working with the Evanston community around a housing strategy. Walnut Hills, we have funded $2.5 million in Walnut Hills to acquire property, to get it ready for development, and they're going to go out with requests for proposals. Same thing in Madisonville, same thing in College Hill, same thing in Westwood, where we're working very diligently right now with the entire community as they're putting together an entire plan to really revitalize their neighborhood business district and capitalize on the investment that we made in the Puppet Theater and the Bell Building, which will become a focal point of new economic activity. So this notion that it's downtown versus the neighborhood is a very old, backward-looking debate. The other most significant thing that the city did recently was actually to put in place something called the Focus 52 Fund. And the reason why that's so significant is because for the first time ever, the city is actually applying the same financing tools in neighborhoods that we have used all the time in downtown, and that is bonding capital projects in neighborhoods, which amplifies and leverages our investment. And so, you know, the Jordan's Crossing project, which is in Bond Hill, we supported that to the tune of $6.8 million, and that was through bonds issuances.
You say that's a backwards-looking
downtown versus neighborhoods,
things.
Yes.
Yeah, but yet it persists.
Only because candidates promote it.
Yeah.
Quite frankly, you know, Mr. Cranley has a vested interest in this campaign of creating divisions, and that's because that's his technique. Divisions, us against them. And, you know, the truth of the matter is everybody celebrates throughout the community what they see as the progress that we have been making. But the question is that all of it? And the answer is no. And is there more to do? Yes. But we are on track and we are doing it. And I am very engaged and have been very engaged since I've been back on council. But I would say that this city council has been a great partner in neighborhoods, investing in them to help them achieve their visions.
This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. We're talking with Cincinnati mayoral candidate Roxanne Qualls. We are taping this segment, so we won't be able to include your phone calls or emails. You have been the chair of the Budget and Finance Committee for the last several years.
Yes.
As the city has dealt with one shortfall after another in the city's general fund, which pays for important services like police and fire and clearing the streets and picking up garbage. The city's budget is structurally unbalanced. The city spends more money than it collects in revenue. On an annual basis. The city manager has said, you know, if we want to keep everything that we have, we have to figure out a way to pay for it. And council has usually balanced the budget with one-time sources of funds or borrowing from another fund to patch things up for a year. What specifically can you say that you would do to bring the city's general fund budget into balance?
Well, a couple of things. First, the city hasn't had a structurally balanced budget since 2002. And in fact, when I was mayor and when I left office, that was around that was the last time we had a structurally balanced budget. So Mr. Cranley oversaw Finance Committee during the entire time when the budget was out of balance. And in fact, it started in 2002 under his watch, and it exploded in 2007 and 8 because of the Great Recession, which impacted everybody. So in the meantime, we have, and I have supported very strongly, a strategy to dig ourselves out that has involved aggressive investment in projects that bring jobs and people and business back into the city of Cincinnati. Over just the last 2 years, actually, from 2010 to 2012, the city, by its investments, either created or preserved almost 7,500 jobs in the city of Cincinnati. We're seeing the results of that strategy as with increased revenues into the city through the income tax, which is very positive. And so the first thing is that we continue that aggressive partnership that allows us to invest in new projects that bring jobs and business and people back into the city. We talked about it a little earlier with all the neighborhood development we're doing, because that really capitalizes on people's desires to live in the city of Cincinnati, as well as businesses to be in Cincinnati. So that's one thing. And that's also the reason why I do support the parking modernization plan, because the money that we will get from it in terms of an upfront payment will be used to invest in economic development and neighborhood development. Second thing that we need to do is look very aggressively at shared services. I've been a strong proponent of that. I've said that that's one of the first things that I will do after I'm elected mayor, which is to reconstitute the Shared Services Commission, to not just look at where we can find cost savings with the county, but with the school system and other political jurisdictions. And the third area is, I think it is a not so hidden truth that there are cost savings to be found in city operations. We haven't done a complete organizational and operational review since the Phillips Commission in the 1980s. We know that we can see significant savings in terms of changing operations, investing in technology improvements, and finding efficiencies and reorganizing how we deliver services.
Might those shared services include law enforcement?
I've made it really clear during this campaign that I felt it was responsible to actually look at the question of whether it ever made any sense for police and sheriff to perhaps be a shared service. Became very clear in looking at it that no, it didn't make any sense. And so that proposal that was made a number of years ago is dead on arrival, is not even, in the discussion. I know that my opponent, John Cranley, keeps bringing it up because he likes to incite people's anxiety, but the truth of the matter is that that hasn't been a viable issue for a long time.
So you're saying it's something you looked at but rejected?
It's only responsible to look at something that someone says has the possibility of saving taxpayers' money, but it clearly, that the sheriff was very clear, would not honor the collaborative agreement. It doesn't make any sense for the city of Cincinnati to do that, from my perspective. And so, no, it's not on the table. Won't be on the table.
During budget discussions, particularly one council member, there's always this question about the size of public safety, which makes up a large portion of the general fund budget. What about the number of police officers and firefighters? Is it correct? Is it too high, too low?
I feel very strongly that we are at the point where we cannot afford to allow our force to further reduce. Now, some good things have happened. When Chief Craig was here, he actually put more officers back on the street by getting them from behind desks. Many of people are aware that in terms of the DARE program, those officers went to the street as well as other officers. That's great. But now we're in the midst of seeing people line up to retire. And so I'm committed in fiscal year 2015 that we are actually going to start a recruit class, and that we'll have a recruit class every year in order to maintain the level of policing that we have in Cincinnati.
Obviously, the pension system is in serious trouble, funded at 61%, I believe, mm-hmm. now. Are the only solutions to this just large infusions of cash, or cutting the liabilities of the system so that the retirees aren't taking out as much? I mean, what is the solution?
Well, we know what the solution is. And so because the Cincinnati Retirement Board and their experts that they work with have actually made the recommendation of what would solve the problem, and it doesn't entail radical, drastic steps that would, such as what is issue four that's on the ballot, and I urge people to vote no on issue four because it will be fundamentally destroy the system and destroy people's retirement security. But the solution is that the 3% compounding COLA, which retirees currently get, needs to be changed to a simple COLA indexed to inflation and capped at either 2 or 3%. In addition to that, the city needs to move up its annual contribution from what will be 24% in 2014 to 28% over the next 5 years. That is what the experts have said will actually address the issue of the unfunded liability. Now, my opponent says he has a solution to it. The problem is what he's proposing, the city of Cincinnati, one, has already done. We have already made the changes to the pension system as it affects current and future employees. We capped their COLA. We changed the method of calculating the pension. We changed the eligibility in terms of years of service. We've done all that. The other thing that John is saying in his budget proposal, which is shocking, quite frankly, is that he would actually, in order to balance his budget to pay for the things he wants, that he would reduce the city's contribution to the pension to 20%. I mean, we have worked to get it to 24% by next year, and what we have to do is get it up higher in order to actually solve the unfunded liability.
How do you get it up higher?
Well, we basically do what we have been doing progressively for the last 4 years, which is as we approve each general fund budget, we are dedicating more money to our contribution to the pension system, which means that we are taking it from other areas of the operating budget.
How should Cincinnati residents react to the pension problem? Should they view it as something they should be concerned about, or there are some council members who think the residents should be in a full-fledged panic?
No.
About the pension system?
Well, a couple things. One is that we have a solution, but it requires political will, and it requires being honest with people. I mean, frankly, you know, the reason why it's easy to talk about, well, we should do all these things that we've already done, as John is talking about, is because he doesn't want to say we have to change the 3% compounding COLA to a simple COLA for current retirees. Because, as a colleague of mine one time said to me in the hallway, because I have provided the leadership on changing the problem, changing the things in the pension system, you know, it's like putting a bullseye on your back. But we know this is the solution. It can be done. It takes political will. It doesn't. People don't have to be in a panic. I know there's also discussion, well, you know, this is impacting the city's bond rating. Yes, there was a downgrade from AA1 to AA2, and any downgrade needs to be taken seriously. It's a significant shot across the bow. But what I would remind people is that we are in the top 16% of all cities in the country in terms of our bond rating, and we're in the company of New York City and Atlanta. So do we need to be concerned, and do we need to take steps and take action? Yes. Do we need to be in a panic? No.
But there would be some kind of sacrifice on the part of retirees.
That they would feel over time.
Right.
You know, because as Einstein once said in response to what did he consider the most miraculous thing in the universe, his response was compounding interest.
In just about 20 or 30 seconds, one of the things you get to do as mayor is select the city manager. Have you given thought to whether Milton Dahoney will stay on as city manager, or are you going to interview him to keep the job, or what direction would you go in selecting a city manager?
Well, first, I think that Milton Dahoney is an excellent city manager, and he has, in partnership with the mayor and council, pursued a very aggressive strategy of investing in developments that bring jobs and people and business to the city of Cincinnati. And so I have nothing but the utmost respect for Milton. The other thing which I have consistently said on the campaign trail in response to a question like that is that I don't think it's appropriate to discuss personnel in public. like just as you would not yourself do. And so what I will do when I'm elected mayor is sit down with Milton and we will talk about, you know, our shared vision, goals, and aspirations and make sure we're in alignment.
Cincinnati mayoral candidate Roxanne Qualls, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Candidate John Cranley will be here next. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. This is Cincinnati Edition. I'm Jay Hanselman with Howard Wilkinson. You just heard from Roxanne Qualls, who's running for mayor on November 5th, and now her opponent, John Cranley, is joining us. Cranley was first appointed to city council in 2000 to replace Todd Portune, who stepped down after being elected Hamilton County Commissioner. Cranley ran successful council campaigns in 2001, 2003, 2005, and again in 2007. He resigned in early 2009 because of term limits and wanting to spend more time on a business venture in Price Hill. We are taping this segment, so we won't be able to include your phone calls or emails. Mr. Cranley, thanks for joining us.
It's great to be here.
So to start off, tell us what qualifies you to be mayor? What background and experiences that would you bring to this job that qualifies you to be mayor for the next 4 years?
Well, I think I bring a lifetime of activities that have enhanced this community. When I left council, as you mentioned, I went into one of the great historic neighborhoods of our city, Price Hill, where I grew up, to create a new development that's added new life, new vibrancy, a new restaurant, Incline Public House, that has a waiting list every night, new apartments, new condos. Now a community theater is coming online. Experience in the private sector to make neighborhoods happen. Every candidate for city office says, I'll do something for the neighborhoods. I'm the only candidate that's made something happen, not just anything, but a development the community embraces in a tough neighborhood in the worst economy in 70 years. And I'm very proud of that, and I think that adds a lot. Secondly, in the private sector, I've at my law firm of Keating, Muth & Kleekamp, I've represented a lot of groups like 3CDC or Crossroads Church with their anti-poverty program in the West End and Vernon Manor Conversion for Children's Hospital. So I've seen a variety of deals in the city, and I can bring that experience to bear. Secondly, I'm proud founder of the Ohio Innocence Project, which uses DNA evidence to help people get out of prison, and that gives me a spark of compassion, having spent time with my clients who were in prison improperly. And I'm proud to say we got 16 people out of prison through DNA technology. And, of course, lastly, I was a city councilman for 8 years and have experience in the public sector. So public, private, nonprofit, right diversity of experiences to understand all aspects of this city, business, government, nonprofit sectors. And I think that will make me a better mayor.
What sets you apart from your opponent?
Well, I think the big differences are the priorities. My opponent is clearly intent on spending as much money as possible on the streetcar and said she wants to spend even more money if she gets elected. And that has resulted in property tax increases, loss of money to our budget to be able to keep cops and firefighters on the street, no money in sight to go to Clifton. And secondly, she's made decisions like deciding to privatize our parking meters and garages that I think is bad stewardship of public assets that we need money for. So I think her priorities, her judgment has been bad. And I think that we need a mayor that's going to be focused on listening to the people and the priorities that people have. People do not prioritize the streetcar or the parking deal. They want police, fire. They want a mayor and council focused on neighborhoods again. And things of that nature. So I think it's really just a matter of choice of priorities and good ideas versus bad ideas.
Let's talk about the streetcar for a minute. Your opposition has been strong and very vocal to this. And is there a particular, if we had the money to be able to take this thing and do phase two to go up to Uptown, would that make it better, more palatable?
Well, certainly the experts believe that the only way to make it a success is to have it go to Clifton. And right now, the city is raising property taxes and borrowing $100 million to go to Findlay Market to a half-baked plan. Roxanne has said that she will go to Washington to ask for more money to go to Clifton. Well, we have to do the Brent Spence Bridge. We have to do I-71 Martin Luther King. We have to redo our sewers. We have to, I think, preserve access for Cincinnati State on I-75. And there are just more important priorities than the streetcar. So whatever good it is, it's not worth putting all eggs into that one basket.
If you are elected mayor, you've said that you will stop this.
Yes.
In order to stop this, you will have to pass an ordinance.
Correct.
Are you reasonably certain that you will have the votes to do that on city council?
I believe so. I mean, I can't guarantee it, but I certainly believe that's likely that if I'm elected, the majority of council will also be in the same position I'm in. Right, the last vote was 5-4, and Roxanne was part of the five. Obviously, her seat's available. I think someone like David Mann is a likely winner, and he is anti-streetcar. And so I think it's likely, and there are other candidates who are running who could do very well as well, that we'll have a majority that feels the same way I do. But I also believe that I will be presenting very stark choices to council about the, you know, one of the things that I feel has been lacking is transparency about the trade-offs that the streetcar has been about. A recent debate Roxanne and I had, she said, well, we don't have to worry about the operating deficit that comes with it because that's not for a couple of years. Well, that's how cities get into big, big problems, is taking on liabilities that get bigger and bigger in the future. So I will certainly be giving council the opportunity to understand the trade-offs, and I will be giving them plenty of options of how those dollars can be better spent.
We're going to talk about the parking lease in just a moment, but in the parking lease, I know you were one of the supporters who said that residents should have a right to vote on the parking lease.
Right.
If an ordinance were passed to stop the streetcar project, would you support the right of citizens to vote on whether that project should move forward?
I'm missing the question.
If with the parking lease, you said that residents had the right to decide whether
get a referendum. Yeah. If we pass an ordinance to stop the streetcar, the citizens have the same right that we had to get a referendum in place in 30 days. It's hard work. And I think it's outrageous that the current council is so arrogant that they, and my opponent, has gone out of her way not only to prevent the people from having the right of referenda, but also a majority of council is now opposed to the parking deal, and she still refuses to let a vote come up to stop it. Look, I support the right of people to exercise their charter rights. If they get the necessary votes within 30 days, that's fine.
But people have voted on this streetcar project in the past.
No, they haven't. They voted on charter amendments to ban all rail in the city twice,
right.
And that was too extreme.
Yeah.
And the campaigns to vote no on those initiatives specifically said voting no does not mean voting yes on the streetcar. And it was about not cluttering up the charter with permanent change that it would ban possibility of light rail and all sorts of other things.
So those charter amendments were too broadly
way written, too extreme, yeah.
And those votes, as far as you're concerned, don't have any impact on what the public opinion is about this particular project.
I can say with a great deal of assurance that the public is strongly opposed to the streetcar plan as it's currently constituted, a half-baked plan that only goes to Findlay Market, that adds to the operating deficit, that raises property taxes. And that's not what they were told was going to happen when those initiatives occurred. But those initiatives weren't about the streetcar. They were about banning all rail in the city.
Let's move on to this parking lease agreement.
Yeah.
I assume that you have seen Port Authority's drafts of contracts with Xerox and Denison to run
the
parking meter system and the garages and the surface lots. What's your assessment of what you've seen in those reports?
Things have gone from bad to worse.
Why?
Well, we were told by the city that the city could hold the Port Authority accountable for a professional standard. Remember, these are the meter maids. People are issuing tickets. You know, these have traditionally been police officers where you have right of due process, you have right of appeal, that we would hold Xerox to a good professional standard. The lease gives the city the right to terminate the contract if that's not happening. The trust indenture, the bond document that governs this deal, takes that right away from the city forever. And so now the city has no the public was told, don't worry, we can hold the Port Authority accountable to professional standards. That has been eviscerated by the trust bond document, trust indenture. Secondly, we were told that rates would be capped at 3% a year. The bond indenture says that if debt service coverage ratio doesn't meet 1.5 to 1, which is a huge coverage ratio, much higher than a traditional bank loan, then all rates must go up to meet that debt service coverage. And that means that this independent board that the city manager was going to be on is a sham, and that there's no caps on increase in rates if the debt service coverage ratio isn't met. And it's worth pointing out that no financials have been shared. So we don't know what the interest rate is. We don't know if it's a levels debt service or, you know, like a home mortgage where you pay the same amount every month, or if principal is being backloaded to the end of the year to increase the return to Guggenheim. So many of the financials are still unavailable to us. And yet the whatever that number turns out to be, the city is giving away the right to prevent rate increases, and yet they told the public that it would be capped at 3% a year, and that's clearly not the case under this deal. And then lastly, you got this deal with Xerox. Walker, the city's own consultant, said that the deal that was originally constituted with Xerox was egregious, a gouging of the taxpayers, because it was paying 2.5 times more than the city is currently paying for this for the operating expenses. And as they pointed out, when you outsource something, you're supposed to save money, not cost more money. And this deal still has a base salary or a payment to Xerox of $4.5 million, 2.5 times greater than we currently pay, plus no cap. And the Port Authority came out in the public said we may end up paying them more, which is going to lead to aggressive enforcement. It's going to lead to hurting our neighborhood business districts. It's going to lead to costing more and driving people and businesses out of the city.
But if they're getting more, why would that lead to more aggressive enforcement? I mean, what's the incentive?
Because they pay themselves first. So in order to put more money and more people on the street, they're going to issue more tickets. That's what they're doing with the individuals they're hiring. And you know, on the waterfall of payments, they pay themselves first. And remember, for each person they hire, they've got a percentage of that goes to the corporation, you know, an overhead, you know, 10% or something like that. So they have an incentive to put more people on the street. They have an incentive to collect more revenue because the payments go to them first before the debt service. That's why the debt service coverage ratio issue that I just mentioned is so problematic, which is that in order to hit a 1.5 to 1 debt service coverage ratio, not only do you have to have that coverage on the debt, but before you even look at the debt, you have to have paid off the operating expenses because the operating expenses are paid prior to debt. So it's really over the revenue, it's more like a 2.5 to 1 because the operating expenses get paid first. And then they have the obligation to raise rates and fines higher if that's not being met. And we were promised that we would get capped at 3% a year. And what we're finding is that everything that we've been told by my opponent about this deal is false. We were told it was an emergency to keep cops and firefighters from being laid off. Not true. We were told that it had to be an emergency in order to prevent the referendum because of that budget crisis. Turned out not to be true. But did they stop the deal? No. We were told that the deal was going to protect rate increases. We now know that's not true. We were told that we were going to have a right to hold them to professional standards. Not true. And for them to rush this through right before an election, I think is egregious. I think it is a disqualifier, in my opinion, for anyone who wants to be mayor, to sell off an asset like this and to sneak it through on such a shady basis right before an election.
With the streetcar, you said that you would try to stop it.
Yeah.
Is there any way, in your opinion, to stop the parking lease? I mean, some of us have been told it's a done deal.
Well, I sure hope so. It is my belief that as long as the bonds have not been issued and spent, that we can stop this. But unlike the streetcar, which I'm confident we can stop, there's 7 weeks here before the next mayor takes office. I would love to be able to tell the voters, I guarantee you I can stop this deal. But what I will promise the voters, I'll do everything in my power to stop it. But I can't promise the voters that that'll happen. And that's one of the best reasons to vote for me, because other decisions like this will happen in the future. And who do you trust when someone's willing to push through a 30 and 50 year deal right before an election, as my opponent is? I think it's very disrespectful of the process.
This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. We're talking with Cincinnati mayoral candidate John Cranley. We are taping this segment, so we aren't able to include your phone calls or emails. In the opening question, you talked about the development that you did in Price Hill.
Yeah.
What kind of plans do you have for other city neighborhoods if you're elected mayor?
Well, I believe the model that works best is the model that we've seen in over the Rhine in downtown with 3CDC, public-private partnerships to revitalize areas that people never thought could be revitalized, which clearly is happening in over the Rhine. What I'd like to do is free up the revenue stream that was originally promised to neighborhoods, the sale of the Blue Ash Airport, $37 million, which was promised to neighborhoods. My opponent, Roxanne, took that money and put it all into the streetcar. We can salvage virtually all those dollars, which would create a neighborhood fund that I think should be used as seed money for neighborhoods that have development ready to go. And I do believe that neighborhoods need to have some skin in the game so that we leverage public dollars in a way that will bring in private investment. And I think that there's some really wonderful development corporations in most of our neighborhoods, and I think they're ready and willing to get moving. But they do need some help from the city.
Cincinnati's general fund budget is structurally unbalanced. The city spends more money than it collects in revenue. What specific plans do you have to make sure that the budget is structurally balanced and not balanced on one-time sources or borrowing from other funds to balance the general fund budget?
Well, first of all, let me say that I was chairman of the Budget Committee for 8 years on council, and I'm proud to say that we balanced the budget every year in a bipartisan manner, put more cops and firefighters
on
the
street. But was it structurally balanced?
I believe it was. I mean, the Enquirer wrote a story recently that suggested it wasn't because we had excess income taxes that were transferred in. But the whole point of a structurally balanced budget is, are your revenues in that year meeting your expenses in that year? And excess income taxes is revenue from that year. And so I believe our budgets were structurally balanced. We did never a couple years ago they took the Convergys settlement, a one-time revenue source, to paper over the deficit. This year they tried to use the parking money to paper over the deficit, one-time revenue source. That's what my definition of a structurally imbalanced budget was. And when I was on council, we had an opportunity, and we were asked to do that with the Anthem dollars, and we refused because I thought it was a bad budgeting practice to take a one-time revenue source to paper over the deficit. But I published a budget on my website that's still there that needs to be updated because some things have changed since then, when I published it in March. But on the whole, it's a good budget that is structurally balanced for the city. It prioritizes basic services, police, fire, parks, recreation, garbage collection, road paving, and health and human services, which is the services we provide to the poor. Those are my sacred items that I think need to be funded first, and then we need to cut the budget in the what I would call the non-essential areas. And I've laid those out very specifically. And secondly, I'll point out that when I was on council, we collected $12 million a year from the parking meters and the tickets. Now they're collecting $7 million. All that money can be used for the general fund budget. Another thing that we were misled about, we were told in the beginning of the parking debate that it couldn't be used, but it can be. I believe if we keep that asset, instead of privatizing it to Wall Street, we will be able to get it back to where it was when I was on council. And that will add $4 or $5 million to our budget in a way that could be very helpful. In addition, we should not be, you know, when you're in a hole, stop digging. And the streetcar adds another, blows another $4 to $5 million annual deficit into the budget. And so by stopping those things, I think we can get it under control.
Let's talk about the pension system, which is obviously in serious trouble.
Yes.
61% funded. It's already caused the bond rating of the city to go down. Your opponent criticizes your plan, saying that while you're saying reduce the city contribution to like 20%, Moody's and others are saying, no, you have to raise the city's contribution into the pension fund in order to save it. Mm-hmm. Who's correct here? Why do you think lowering the 20% would be?
Well, first of all, I don't. That's a very misleading statement that my opponent has been making on the campaign trail. The 20% is the current level that she set in this budget, and it maintains the 20%, number one. Number two is I'm not proposing 20%. I've proposed canceling the streetcar project and freeing up the debt capacity to buy down at least $100 million. 20% of the general fund payroll is roughly $20 million a year in payroll contribution. What I'm proposing is that we keep the 20% plus make an immediate down payment of $100 million by freeing up debt capacity, by getting out of things we can't afford to take on debt for, like the streetcar. So while it's true that she's pointing to one document that's in the general fund operating budget where I said the annual contribution should be 20%, she's neglecting to point out that I also have a proposal to put $100 million in, which if you added that all together would be like 120% of payroll for the first year and would significantly buy down the liability. So it is deeply misleading to suggest that I'm dramatically increasing the money that's going to buy down that liability. I'm also proposing a more comprehensive solution, which is changing benefits on a prospective basis, changing investment strategies. You know, it's a three-legged stool: investments, benefits, and unfunded and the money that we put in.
Changing benefits, how?
Yeah. Well, what I'm proposing is on a prospective basis that people have to work longer before they can start collecting their checks. We've got to reduce the multiple on which they get paid out. We have to end abusive practices like saving up sick and vacation time to bump your number at the end, banning double dipping. You know, in the middle of this election, in the middle of this crisis, after Moody's downgraded our debt for the first time ever under Roxanne's watch, never happened on my watch, they repealed the ban on double dipping so they could hire someone new on the streetcar project, John Dietrich, which says to me they're not serious about any of these financial matters. It's so incredibly insensitive to be banning repealing the ban on double dipping so they can spend more money on a streetcar on a project that's already $50 million over budget when we have crisis like the pensions that need to be tackled.
What impact would that have on the average retiree? And I'm, you know, not talking about John Dietrich, who is not the average
right
city.
Are you what would what have on the average?
Your plan.
Oh, well, I mean, on a prospective basis, it's going to be a much smaller benefit on a prospective basis. So, you know, I think right now the average person is getting somewhere in the range of 70% of their average pay, and under my plan it would be closer to 50. So it's a pretty significant reduction.
When you're saying prospective, you mean
for new
future.
Hires.
So
yeah.
You wouldn't touch any of the retirees' current benefits?
No.
Even if the retirement board suggested changing the compounding COLA, you don't see that changing?
Well, I don't believe we should make retroactive changes.
There's always a lot of talk during election years about public safety.
Yeah.
And in your mind, what is the right number of police officers and firefighters for the city? Is it the current number? Does it need to be increased? Does it need to be decreased?
Oh, it needs to be increased on both fronts. I mean, on the fire department side, we are having brownouts on a daily basis. And you know, brownout means that if you, God forbid, you have a heart attack or your loved one has a heart attack and you need an ambulance to get to your home, they don't have an ambulance ready to respond. I mean, this is a public health crisis. On the police side, you know, we have to pay back grants to the federal government because we took money on the condition we would keep a certain number of officers on the street. Now we got to pay it back. In District 3, where my parents live, there is not if you call 911 according to Captain Neville, who's a captain of District 3, from 10 a.m. to 2 a.m. every day but Sunday, there is not someone able to respond to a 911 call. Homicides are up by 50%. So I believe at a minimum we need to get back to 1,000 officers and maybe more, but we probably can't afford to get much higher than that right now. We had a high a couple years ago of 1,135. I don't think in the short term we can afford to go back to that, but I think we need to at least get back to about 1,000.
And you pay for it how?
We pay for it by reprioritizing public safety and deprioritizing a lot of things that are less important. You know, as I like to point out, in the general fund budget is roughly $370 million, if you count the casino money, which I do. And police, fire, parks, recreation, garbage collection, road paving, and all the money for the poor, health and human services, collectively is $300 million. Everything. There's still $70 million. And most people are saying to themselves, I got my cop, I got my firefighter, I got my garbage picked up, I got my road paved, I got my park, my rec, and we've got some money for the poor. What else are you doing? And I think that's where we're going to have to find the savings.
Just as we wrap up here in about 30 or 40 seconds, one of the things that the mayor would do is select the city manager. And I think that you said on the record that Milton Dohoney would be able to apply for the city manager's job.
Yeah.
What qualities are you looking for in a city manager?
I'm looking for the qualities of restoring transparency and openness, not trying to push through deals right before the election like the streetcar and the parking deal. And I'm looking for someone who's going to prioritize public safety, basic services, and implement the vision that I've laid out throughout this campaign.
Do you think that that's something that you can do rather quickly, or is that going to take some time?
I want to do it as fast as possible. I'm not going to commit to a timeline on it, but certainly it's going to be job number one.
Cincinnati mayoral candidate John Cranley, thanks for joining us this afternoon.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for listening to Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. Archives of our programs are available on our website, wvxu.org. Producer for today's program was Pete Reitmeier. Our technical directors were Bruce Ellis, Kevin Rowinski, and Rick Andrus. With Howard Wilkinson, I'm Jay Hanselman.